Hey, everybody, we got a great one today. You know, for a change, because I got Tim Miller, host of the Bulwark Podcast, joining me once again, and for the first time, Aaron Blake of the Washington Post. So they're together. So this one will be, as I said, a great one. We talk about two things, really. The Walz-Vance debate, where there's a funny moment when Vance accuses the one of the moderators of fact-checking. Hey, there's no fact-checking. That was not Vance's best moment. But Vance's worst moment came when Walz asked Vance whether Trump had lost the 2020 election, and Vance refused to answer. The fact is that he has said that if he had been in Pence's position, he would have sent it back to the states. You know who's going to preside over the next one? Vice President Kamala Harris. She'll be in the same position that Al Gore was in January 2001, where he lost to George Bush by 537 votes in Florida and the Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote. They stopped the recount. So it was really one vote. This court put its thumb on the scale when they took forever to decide the immunity case in the most extreme way possible. A president could have a rival candidate assassinated and be immune if he could make the case that it was part of his official duties. That doesn't seem right to me. The court is one of the reasons that we must absolutely win this election. Alito and Thomas are poised to leave if Trump wins and to be replaced by 40-year-old versions of themselves. And you know that their benefactors will make sure that they have luxurious retirements. So get out there and do something. Door knock. You have kids? Let me tell you something. An 8-year-old knows how to use a microwave oven. An 8-year-old can teach a 5-year-old to use a microwave oven. They can make dinner. Get out on the doors or phone bank. I'm talking to those of you in battleground states. If you can't door knock, phone bank. I won my first race by 312 votes. You, my friends, can make a difference. And if you're not in a battleground state and you got a house race or a Senate race that's close, or a state Senate or a state house race, lend a hand, do something. You can make a difference. Okay, I'll stop nagging. We got Tim Miller and Aaron Blake and a great one. You know, for a change. Well, we had a couple big events I wanted to talk to you guys about. The debate. And then Jack Smith has put this filing out on January 6th. Basically saying here's the case, minus anything that you could say was covered by immunity, right?
Right. Basically laying out the evidence that he would like to include in the trial underneath the parameters that the Supreme Court has essentially set in this immunity case. So they've said Trump is immune from these things and other presidents are immune from these things. And so now this court case is trying to figure out what can actually be included in this trial when it ultimately happens. And so that's why we got a huge download of what the kind of blueprint of Jack Smith's case was, because he has to lay that out.
Was there anything in the filing that you said, oh boy, they're not going to let that through? Or, I mean, and what has to happen with this thing? It has to be adjudicated by Chutkan,
right?
Who's the judge. Yep. She's going to say whether we can have a trial with this stuff, whether it touches on stuff that he should be immune from. That, to me, it looked pretty clean on that score.
Yeah, I mean, the filing is about basically laying out that the things they want to introduce are private stuff, as campaign stuff, rather than official stuff. That's the line that the Supreme Court effectively drew. And even in the filing, they allude to some things where they're like, you know, this is important for what we're talking about, but we're not planning to introduce this as evidence. You know, some of the Pence stuff would be considered potentially official and they can't use that.
What about when he's talking to Pence about not certifying? I mean, is that official or not official?
I mean, it's difficult because you're talking about Pence's official function in Congress that day, but also Trump is, you know, talking about his own campaign. And basically they're saying that all of these instances of Trump reaching out to officials out in these states and, you know, leaning on people to do what he wanted. This was about the campaign, because when he was doing this, he wasn't asking about voter fraud more generally. He wasn't asking about this U.S. Senate race and whether this race was also swung, or, you know, the local House race. He was just focused on himself. And so that proved that this was about his campaign in particular and not his duties as president.
Well, that's not surprising that he was thinking about himself as opposed to the Republicans down ticket.
Not a character.
So this will go to court if Trump loses the election. And if he wins the election, this won't go to court.
Yeah, we're boned if he wins the election. So beating him is pretty important as it relates to the legal side of things. The interesting thing that I found in here, Al, was that Jack Smith has his phone data, forensic data from Trump's phone.
Yeah.
So this was the most interesting element to me. They were able to determine that at the same time as he was sitting in that little dining, they call it a dining room, but it's kind of a small little kitchenette type thing where he has a Super TiVo. He did a very important redesign of the White House, where right off the Oval Office, he put a massive TV with a Super TiVo in there so that he could watch cable news. Wanted to prioritize. And so he sits in there. He's watching. We knew that he was sitting in there watching the news.
The coverage, but the Fox.
But they know
coverage.
Now, because of the phone data, that he was on Twitter on his phone. He's watching Fox on his phone. And at the time that Fox is interviewing one of the protesters who says that they're disappointed in Pence for not certifying, and then the next thing Fox does is talk about how there are reports that a police officer has been injured and that the Capitol is breached. It is at that time that Trump sends the famous tweet that says Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done. So it's like, we knew, right, that Trump didn't care about this. He knew a riot was happening. He liked the riot. But I did think that was pretty interesting to know that they like have his phone data and now know kind of like what prompted that tweet. And I think that's a pretty damning revelation.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, because even the evidence put forward by the January 6th committee kind of pointed in this direction that he knew these things were happening. You know, we had Pat Cipollone saying that he brought these things to Trump's attention around 2 o'clock. And then the tweet came at 2:24 p.m. There was an anonymous White House staffer who they didn't name, who said that he alerted Trump to this. This includes more detail on Trump being told that. There's actually a footnote at one point that I think some people have missed, where Trump is told, quote, there's a riot and there are people inside the Capitol building, and quote, someone's gotten into the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And these are before the Pence tweet. So Trump would have heard these things and decided to go ahead with attacking his vice president. And then, of course, there's the thing after that where the filing says that Trump was told by a staffer, it doesn't say who, after the Pence tweet, that Pence had been taken to a secure location. Mm-hmm. And Trump, according to this staffer, apparently responded, so what? Which I think gets at the large volume of evidence that suggests Trump was at least indifferent to what was happening to Pence and the danger that was there, and might have even seen some utility in this unrest that was taking place at the Capitol.
He might have meant good. He's in a safe place.
I mean, there's other, I don't have the chapter and verse right now. Yeah. I don't have the chapter and verse, but I feel like there's a number of other comments in which Trump reportedly expressed a similar sentiment about his vice president being endangered. So,
yeah, it's chilling if you think about it. So is this going to have an effect on the election? No.
I've always been slightly more skeptical than is the conventional wisdom that the Comey letter was really the thing that pushed Trump over. But like that said, you never can really know. There's a chicken and egg element to all this. But like, people broke late for Trump against Hillary. It was a certain group of people. There are people that were the double haters. They didn't like either candidate, and they voted for Trump. And in 2020, people that didn't like either candidate broke late for Biden. And this time, they're still even smaller. Than this number gets smaller each cycle. Like, there's a group of people, you know, it's my former people, right? They're Republicans, mostly middle to upper income, in the suburbs, mostly men. they don't like Donald Trump that much. They don't particularly like Kamala Harris. And they right now might be thinking, I'm going to do what John Bolton said. He changed his write-in from Dick Cheney to Ronald Reagan. He's getting further and further back in history. I don't know. He's going to do John Adams next. People like that, can some percentage be nudged from saying, ugh, I'm not going to vote for either of them, to like saying, okay, I'll actively vote for Harris. Liz Cheney is in Wisconsin today making that case for people. This filing, I think that there is, you know, not 5% of the electorate, not a huge percentage, but there are some people out there that could still be nudged in the last month.
Well, this whole thing is going to be decided by less than 5% in every swing state, and in many cases, probably by 11,780 or that kind of number.
Yeah. I think Tim's exactly right here. The kind of knee-jerk reaction to all of these things with Trump is like, well, that didn't matter. You know, the indictments didn't matter. He still won the Republican primary. You know, he's more popular than he was when he was president right now. So clearly that didn't have an impact. Well, it can have an impact on the margins. And I think it's also worth noting that if you look at the polls of just how much people actually knew about these court cases, they don't know a whole lot. The classified documents case, there was a poll last year that showed like 60% of independents didn't really know any details about the classified documents case. So these things coming out on the eve of an election, in a very close election, that can matter to some people who might not really have registered in the polls before. And so I'm less kind of skeptical that nothing matters with Trump than a lot of people are. I think it matters in a close election.
If you move the dial a tenth of a percent in, you know, North Carolina, that might be all the difference. That and Mark Robinson.
What did you think about that Mark Robinson story, Al? I wasn't listening to your podcast that day, I guess, about the, you know, where he's in the bag, he's eating pizza and watching the Peep Show. It's an interesting lifestyle choice. I don't know.
I like how pretty much everybody on his campaign quit, which was confirming, okay, that's him. We know it. And, you know, we know Black Nazi.
They're like, we know it's Mini Soldier because that is also his handle on Reddit and Pinterest.
Yeah, it's him. What a sick man. But it's amazing that the Republican Party overwhelmingly got behind him. It wasn't even close in the primary, right?
No, it wasn't close.
Yeah, it was like, it was not quite 50 points, but it was somewhere around there. It just wasn't a serious primary race. But
he was running against somebody that was like, you know, I don't know, what's a good generic Southern name, Al?
Like Dale
Fortenberry.
Dale Fortenberry. It was like, yeah. Dale Fortenberry. He was like a local businessman. He was just a white guy, you know, that just like had conventional views about pro-life and tax cuts. And it was fine. His opponent was it wasn't like he was running against a nobody. It was just a generic old school Republican, and he got
annihilated. Had the Fortenberry name behind him too.
They're like, we want the Black Nazi, we want the Holocaust denier, we want the porn addict. That's what we want. So
remember,
that's a problem.
So what did Trump call him? Martin Luther King on steroids.
Yeah, steroids. Yeah.
Martin Luther King 2.0 initially, and then he upgraded him to Martin Luther King on steroids. My favorite part of that bit was that Trump is on stage talking about it, and Trump's like, you know, I was calling him this, And I was getting a sense that he didn't like it. And you can tell in Trump's head, he's thinking, oh, maybe I offended him. Maybe the black guy doesn't want, you know, this comparison to Martin Luther King. Maybe it's like sacrilegious or something. But what it turns out is Trump was onto something. He probably was offended because in his messages on the Bourne message board, he wanted to tear down the Martin Luther King statue because he was a communist and terrible. And he hated Martin Luther King. So he didn't take it as a compliment to be called Martin Luther King 2.0.
So instead of Martin Luther King on steroids, he's kind of Hitler on acid.
Yeah, there you go, or something.
I would say.
By the way, the opponent in Mark Robinson's primary, I was right. It was Dale. Dale Folwell.
And an S name.
I may have subconsciously known that. And he actually is the North Carolina state treasurer. So not like a small-time guy.
Yeah.
I don't think treasurer is a huge office in North Carolina, but, you know.
But it wasn't like a quick sign. It wasn't like some random person. Like, yeah. It was a legit opponent.
And he got 20-some percent or something like that, or what?
He got 19.2% to Mark Robinson's 65%. So this race is interesting because, you know, Republicans had a lot of these bad candidates in the 2022 election where they were Trump backed in the primary and that was good enough and they got through and they wound up being disasters for the party in the general election. And this was a lot of races. And Republicans kind of avoided having that happen in too many races this time around. But you still had, you know, Kari Lake getting through in Arizona. You had Mark Robinson getting through in North Carolina. And both of these people is like, you know, the black Nazi stuff about Mark Robinson, that just came out. But there's a lot of other stuff that existed out there before. Like the writing was on the wall that this could be a problem. And for whatever reason, there just wasn't a desire to try and get somebody in ahead of him. Maybe they just didn't think that they could do that somehow because he was the sitting LG. But it's really remarkable that they turned a blind eye to this, given the stakes.
He was a Holocaust denier. He was pro-Hitler. He liked Hitler.
He said, he's talking about the gays are filth.
Yeah.
Scum. Takes one to no one kind of says. It's like more of a he who smelt it, dealt it kind of situation there, I think. But yeah, no, it was known. It was known. I mean, the black Nazi stuff wasn't known, but the general gist was known. And he was also a disaster. He hadn't done anything. He'd had bankruptcy several times. Like, it wasn't like, oh, this is shocking news. You know, this was a pillar of the community that you had this, he has this little dark side.
I guess he, you know, they asked Trump to ask him to withdraw, to tell him to withdraw. And Trump said, his name's on the ballot. They're already sending out the overseas ballot. So who's going to run in his place? You know, how would you like that? Okay. I'll do it. I'll be on the ballot.
I mean, it would have been tough. They were right up against the deadline for even getting him out of the race and having somebody, you know, basically get his votes. You know, they had like basically 12 hours to figure this out on the day that it was happening. But we have seen this situation before. There was, people might remember the Mark Foley scandal in the House back in the mid-2000s. They couldn't get Mark Foley's name off the ballot. They had somebody running, you know, in his place who was going to get votes that were cast for Mark Foley. I think it was like Punch Foley for this guy was the slogan. And that guy got 48% of the vote. I mean, that wasn't good. That wasn't great for a Republican in that district because it's a pretty Republican district. But like, they were able to convince people to do that, a lot of people.
Yeah, well, but it's kind of, our military guys are getting these ballots. You know, anyway, the point is Robinson still there? And the point is that Robinson, will he hurt Trump?
Yes. Like traditionally, yeah, like look, there's not reverse coattails. Like there's that, I mean, like, there will be people that vote for Josh Stein and Trump. But I just like the environment, again, like the types of voters that like we talk to at the Bulwark and at like my colleagues are along with those Republican voters against Trump, they're not deciding between Trump and Harris. They're deciding between not voting and Harris. And so if you live in Georgia and Brian Kemp's your governor and you're like, okay, the Republicans in my state are like pretty normal still, and I hope that the party comes back. Like, you know, that just is a different environment to be in than to be in North Carolina, where you're like, ugh, it's like Trump and the black Nazi. And like, maybe just this one time, I can just vote for Josh Stein and Kamala, and hopefully things go back to normal next time. Right? Like, I just, like, psychologically, there's got to be some percentage of voters that impacts, or that they just say, I'm going to golf today. Like, I'm not going to go vote for Trump, who I don't really like, because there's nothing else to get me to go vote. I you know, in an 11,000 vote situation, I think it matters. It's not a 3% switch, but it's something.
Yeah, I mean, the voter that's going to show up and vote for Pat McCrory and just, you know, check the box for Trump alongside him. Pat McCrory is the former kind of traditional Chamber of Commerce Republican governor of North Carolina. The other point of this is that, yes, I agree with Tim, not no impact, but maybe a small impact. Mark Robinson, the way he's doing right now is historically bad relative to the top of the ticket. I actually went back and looked at the numbers from
really?
Some of these other candidates in recent years that really, well, I mean, we've had other candidates with stuff like this. You remember Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch all those years ago?
Remember Todd Akin had nothing like that. I was at the RNC then. We threw that guy overboard just because he didn't think that you could have a baby if you got raped.
Yeah.
And that's a bad opinion to have, okay? Like, that's a bad opinion. You can have a baby if you get raped, and that is something that there should be laws to allow you to deal with. But, like, there was no evidence that Todd Akin was cranking it in the back of a porn shop with a pizza. I mean, it's like he was better than Robinson.
Robinson's down like 16, 17 points in the polls, even as the top of the ticket is very close. And another element of this that I think is important is it's not just that people really don't like Mark Robinson, which is very much the case. It's also the case that Josh Stein, who's the attorney general there, is pretty popular. Like, this guy's running up kind of Josh Shapiro-esque image numbers in this campaign. And so you have this other race in the ticket where it's not just that the Republican looks bad. It's also that people like the Democrat who's on the ticket. And maybe that gives some people the permission structure to
vote for Kamala,
vote for the Democratic ticket, because it looks better to them, that these two candidates might look better to them than these other two candidates.
Is the hurricane, is that going to affect voting in some of these areas, especially the rural areas that it just are down? We don't know.
Yeah. My colleague Philip Bump here at the Washington Post did a piece on this the other day, which I'll confess that I haven't read, but that basically laid out the idea that
what do you think he said?
If I know my colleague Philip, and I do know him very well, so I can probably guess. But I think the point is, like, the areas that were the hardest hit tend to be the more conservative areas. So to the extent this creates problems and people don't ultimately turn out to vote, maybe that comes at the expense of the Republican side of the ticket.
Go back to the debate for a second. I thought there was a moment that no one commented on. They talked about climate. And Vance talked about, well, we want clean air and clean water. As if, you know, CO2 is transparent. You can't see whether CO2 is in the air.
Acid rain.
That's not the issue. And of course, everyone let it go. I mean, he elided a lot of issues in the debate. And until Tim asked him about, did Trump lose?
Yeah.
And I thought that was a real winning moment.
I did too. It was 96 minutes into the debate, but thank goodness it's 2024. So most people are just watching it on TikTok or whatever anyway. The clean air and clean water thing is a Trump line. Like, that's what Trump does. Like, JD stole that from Trump. That's how Trump elides this answer too. He just like, I care about the environment. I want, you know, I just don't really care about imaginary climate change. Obviously, not a good answer on the merits, but it is. They've gotten away with it. This was my like walls thing. And you guys maybe can give some insight on this, but as Minnesotans, the non-confrontation. I'm confrontational. I like to confront. I come from a long line of confronters, and so like, it was frustrating for me as a viewer. Maybe it worked for other people. I'm not the median voter. I mean, there are probably 10 examples of what you're talking about, Al, where like I'm shouting at the TV and I'm like, Tim, what are you doing? Like, say this. And like, he was just going with a different strategy than that. Like, he was not there to say, oh, this is a ridiculous point, JD Vance. Like,
I wonder if that was preordained as a strategy, or he got into that because he had been faltering.
Yeah, that was going to be my thought. You know, he had this kind of nervous start where he was answering the Iran or Israel question.
Kind of a ridiculous question, really.
The preemptive strike, president. Yeah. Like the, like,
you can bomb Iran, also, yeah. The vice presidential debate, question one. I mean, it's like, that's not really in the vice president's remit.
Yeah.
But anyway.
The other thing was like, Walls kept saying like, well, I think JD agrees with me on this and, you know, really wants to solve this problem. And meanwhile, you're standing across from a guy who is the most unpopular VP nominee since Sarah Palin, probably, kind of really drives home the negatives that already exist on the Republican ticket as far as their appeal to women and things like that. And it just made me think that, yeah, maybe it was kind of a play it safe approach, but also maybe they just didn't have confidence in Walls to do that, to really go after his opponent in that way and kind of have a good debate. They maybe thought JD Vance was just going to be better at that kind of a debate. And they wanted to get past this and not have some of those moments. So, yeah, it was an interesting choice for me that they. Mm-hmm.
I think it was a Midwestern tick. You don't think it's a Midwestern tick? Like, oh, I agree with you. You're making some good points. It's like, no, he's not. He's not making any good points.
I think they wanted to basically make the case that even J.D. Vance knows that Trump is way out there and like he's not even on board, you know, pointing to the past criticisms about America's Hitler and things like that, basically saying, look, this guy's on stage. He doesn't even believe what this other guy's doing.
I thought that Tim scored when he asked him whether Trump won the election.
Absolutely.
Trump lost the election. And that is you know, that combined with this filing, you know, raises this basic existential issue. Can you actually elect a guy president who did everything he could to overturn the Democratic election? That should be at the center of this whole thing. That should be the first thing people are voting on, I would think.
Totally agree. It should be. I don't know if it is for people that aren't as engaged in politics, but I think that there's a demo of people that are. And you know, we said this, so I think you combine all of this, like, it's a good information environment for the Dems. It's like the probably the most memorable exchange from the debate is going to be that about how JD wouldn't say who won the 2020 election. It was Joe Biden. And then the filing is the next day. And then the first Harris event with Liz Cheney, where obviously that's what Liz Cheney will focus on, follows that. So like, that's a good, I think, information, you know, sort of environment for the Harris-Walz ticket.
So is Israel going to launch?
It's not in my remit as a podcast host either. Would you do a preemptive strike on Iran, Senator Franken?
You know, there's a couple of choices they have to make.
Yeah.
And one is whether to go after the nuclear facilities. Yeah. That's a major step, and that would be full-scale war with Iran. There you go.
So is that a yes or was that a maybe?
I would consult with my generals is what I would do, right?
Well, that's right. So if there's a full-scale war between Israel and Iran and brings in the Houthis and brings in everybody, does this hurt us in Michigan?
It's probably not great, I don't think. So if we could just chill for 5 weeks on that. I don't, like, it's the inverse.
Well,
like,
at least we have a lot of influence with Netanyahu. And
yeah, that's probably not, huh? Could we get some influence over the longshoremen then? Could we get you in there, Al, and try to tell them to, like, I think December would be a good time to strike, right? Let's maybe cool down a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned about the outside media. If the inside the campaign media environment is about January 6th, that's good for Harris. It's a little concerning, the Middle East and the strikes creating a bad outside environment for.
Well, they did that on purpose, I'm sure. So,
the longshoremen and Beebe?
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible. No, like, are you being sarcastic? Or is it
no, true? I mean, the longshoremen probably timed their strike for this so they can get it done fast, I hope.
So they can get it done before the election?
Yeah, so there'll be a lot of
more pressure on them to cut a deal.
Yeah, that hopefully the president can get in there and deal with this. That's his job right now.
Tim Walz being nice in the longshoreman's strike is making me feel more like a Republican than I have in a long time. I'll tell you that. I'm like, some of my old muscles are firing.
Tim's rejoining the team. I love it.
I'm not rejoining any team. I'm just saying some of the old inside, some of like the little synapses.
You left the team a long time ago.
It's been a while. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you remember what it was like to be on the team?
I do. I still remember. I mean, it's starting to fade, you know. We're all getting older. But I still remember what it's like to be on the team. I'm happier, by the way, off the team. Much happier. Much
more fulfilled. Oh, yeah. You're doing great work.
Thank you. But sometimes old habits die hard.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Tim Miller and Aaron Blake. So we got how long now? Five? 4 weeks? 4 weeks. 4 weeks? 5 weeks?
I'd round up to 5 at this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have you been watching the polling? Because to me, the polling is just like in every state, it's within 2 points or so.
I want to know what Aaron thinks about this because I have a conspiracy theory on this.
All right.
I think they're hurting. I think that Nate Silver and all these guys giving these pollsters a rating has created a disincentive for them to want to not be wrong really bad. And so, like just mathematically, there should not be 10 Pennsylvania polls in a row within 2 points of each other. Like, that shouldn't, like, that's not how statistics works. Like, there should be outliers. I'm starting to become conspiratorial about the data.
I'd actually say we'd probably see more variation in Pennsylvania polls. I think the Washington Post poll was like a tie, and then we had all the way up to like 5 or 6 point Harris lead. So there's some variation in there. I think the point that I would make is that we're seeing this kind of bifurcated landscape where all these southern swing states look better for Trump and all these northern ones look better for Harris.
That would be fine. That would be fine.
Yeah. I mean, now that Nebraska is settled, the electoral vote's not going to go to Trump there, not going to go to Trump there in Omaha, it looks like. She just needs Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And I think it's increasingly looking like that's kind of the ball game for her. And so,
God, would it be weird if it was 270 to 268?
I struggled to think of something that would be, I mean, I couldn't think of things that would be worse for the country.
Well, the good news is I think that the Trump would like just accept it, the will of the people, and like his fans, I think, would just say, all right, guys, it was a close one. We'll get you next time.
What would he do? I mean, and are these votes going to be certified in the states? I mean, there are what Georgia is doing, other states are doing, and trying to stop votes from getting up to the, you know, to the state by saying we have to figure out whether there's been some fraud, et cetera.
And that's part of what made this difficult in 2020 for him trying to overturn the election was just this size of his loss. Like, it wasn't just one state or two states. He had to do it in at least three states to get them to do what he wanted to. And that was never really feasible, which is why they turned to Mike Pence in January 6th itself. If it's one state and, you know, he's been leaning on this party and some of these people for a longer period of time, and the election denialism has taken over in the Republican Party, and these county supervisors aren't certifying the results in their area, it kind of opens up Pandora's box. And so that's why I say, you know, 270 to 268 is probably not a great outcome for a democracy at this point.
So Kamala Harris will be the one certifying, right?
Overseeing the certification.
Overseeing the certification.
Yeah.
The vote of Congress to certify, or is
it, yeah, no? Basically they accept the results, and you know, she handles objections. And of course, after 2020, they made it more difficult for those objections to actually succeed. So, you know, even if it weren't her, it would be more difficult once it got to that point in the process. But I think the bigger point here is what's going to be happening at the state and local level, which is where a lot, and the democracy team at the Washington Post has been doing a lot of work on this, looking at how these election deniers have taken over some of these counties and are basically threatening to kind of wreck shop in this whole election. So statewide, it's tough. Nationally, it's tough. The local areas where they can really mix things up.
And that's happening not just in Georgia, but in
Arizona. Is another big one, of course. That's been a very kind of far right Republican Party for a long time.
And this is Mark Elias stuff. I mean, this is,
yeah. Michigan's another one I'd watch for. Those are kind of the big ones.
The good news is Carrie Lake was defeated, seriously, because really Nevada is the only one that has kind of a wild card, potentially governor, and who knows, that governor might do the right thing. We just hasn't been tested. That's a Republican. But it's Democratic governors across the blue wall. It's Roy Cooper, Democrat in North Carolina. It's Kemp, who, for any policy complaints you have about him, did the right thing in 2020. And so had Lake beat Hobbs, you know, I think we would be in potentially a really dangerous situation there. But with Katie Hobbs in Arizona at the statewide level, to your point, Aaron,
and the Secretary it's a little of State less also,
scary.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a little less scary at the statewide level than it could have been had the midterms gone differently.
But I don't know. I think Nevada, I know the governor's Republican. I don't see that being a
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, boy. Well, we've got four or five weeks, and I'm just as nervous as hell.
I don't think that there's going to be enough. Oh, this is the bad news for you, Senator, but I don't think there's going to be anything over the next 5 weeks that is going to make you feel comfortable about where this is headed. I don't think a swing like that is possible at this point.
My listeners will be happy to hear that.
Yeah. I'm also nervous. I'm happy you're nervous. I'm feeling a little more comfortable because I felt like I was kind of alone in being nervous about 2 weeks ago. There's a lot of happy talk about the Kamala momentum. And it feels like everybody's getting nervous now, which is right. Nerves are important, I think, going ahead. I think that Hillary was really harmed by the fact that everyone just assumed she was going to win. I think that there was a meaningful loss in votes.
Well, it,
there.
It gave people permission to vote for
Jill Stein, or Gary Johnson or whatever.
This is the thing I don't understand. There is so much bickering on social media these days about like the polls that don't show Harris in a good enough position. Like people are diving into the crosstabs and trying to prove why this poll is not accurate. And meanwhile, Harris is out there like talking about herself as an underdog this whole time. It's like, no, she like those polls that show her down or tied, like that seems to be what her campaign wants people to see. So, you know, maybe this dumb argument you're having about whether this poll is accurate doesn't really mean anything and kind of is counterproductive to what the campaign's trying to do. Anyways, that's just my
rant. I've also
noticed
that, Aaron.
Yeah, I understand why people do it because you want to believe that your side is going to win, but I think it's a self-defeating exercise.
I think it's based on a misconception about election and polls where it's like thinking about it like sports, where it's like the poll result is the first quarter and we want to be winning in the first quarter. And it's like, actually, no, that's not how it works. It
the
doesn't point, matter
the points that you make in this poll do not apply to the end
do
of the game.
Right. Well, yeah, it's just neck and neck and we have no idea who's going to. I just don't know. And hopefully this Jack Smith case is going to do something. But this is enough time for something else to happen that we don't know about.
For sure.
Okay. Hey, thanks for doing this, guys. Aaron?
Thanks, Al. Love coming on.
Thanks, Senator. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.